Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. This is my dad, Ted.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky. So, just about 11 months ago, I had interviewed Liz Murray. And you're about to listen to that interview. I held on to this for almost an entire year because it was so inspiring to me, and many of you had attended the Ensuring Great Leadership Conference and heard her in person. So I wanted to bring it back as a reminder of what a powerful message it has, what a great leader she is, and how she demonstrates to us that we all do have an inner buffalo, and that if we're perseverant, display tenacity, and never give up on ourselves or others, great things can happen. So enjoy this conversation between me and Liz Murray. All right, so I'm joined today via Zoom or Skype with Liz Murray, author, advocate, and one of my favorite things about her is that she has propelled her journey into working for the underdogs of the world to ensure that they have a great future. So welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast, Liz.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So tell us a little bit about growing up in the Bronx. Our audience is all over the world, but most of us live here in Wisconsin. And what was it like for you as a kid?
Yeah, sure. So the Bronx, which I actually find has quite the reputation, no matter where I go in the world. But if you're not familiar, it's one of the grittier parts of New York City. And for me growing up there in the 80s and 90s, what that was like, I mean, you know, it was a mixed bag. Let's call it that. We had a lot of your standard issues like gangs and drugs and violence, but we also had what I now identify as a pretty amazing community. And so it was this wonderful mix and a time in my life where I could really be I really shouldn't have been in the street at such a young age, but my parents were addicted to drugs and I didn't have much supervision. And I, as a child, began going out on my own very early and sort of roaming the streets of the Bronx and finding a sense of independence that might have come a little bit too early. And so for a kid, that's fun. But from the perspective of long-term trajectory on my life, I had no idea what I was in for when their drug addiction became severe. Mm-hmm. And really, it shaped the course of my life.
So there's this great saying that people can be book smart and sidewalk stupid or street smart and book stupid. You're both, you're both, not the stupid part, of course, but the book smart.
Well, I was going to ask. But.
Yeah. Book smart and sidewalk smart. What kind of things did you learn, you know, out there?
Yeah, I mean, well, it was such a rich, you know, I wouldn't trade my childhood for anything. And I know that might sound strange because, okay, my parents were on drugs. And for anyone, just for a little context, they had lived that whole, you know, that disco era in New York City in the late 70s and early 80s. They were kind of getting high like there was no tomorrow. And we grew up in the aftermath of what happened when the party was over. And so because we lived in that context, here we are living off of government checks, really not much food in the fridge. Our parents spend most of the day either getting high or recovering from being high. And so people hear that and they just assume blanket tragedy. But, it's not like life is not like that. As the saying goes, the good and the bad are happening side by side. They're both true. And so I had these parents who had all these problems, but I experienced them as deeply loving to the extent that they could be. And so I had, parents who kissed me all over the face, hugged me, told me I was precious, but really were not able to be there for me. So I went out into the world with this secure base of I'm loved, but what do I do about my life? Because I had no preparation. I would go into school. And we know now so much more about trauma with kids, but what I was dealing with at home and watching them OD and use and all of that, I would sit in the classroom and really be at odds with myself because I couldn't take the lessons that the teacher was trying to teach, which seems so abstract. You know, they're taking out a map and pointing to a foreign country in another place or social studies or math. I was hungry. I was tired. And I had no sense of how to even be in my body. So I would go out in the streets and I made a lot of friends, and I grew up, I joke with my husband a lot that there are a bunch of photo albums in random Puerto Rican families in the Bronx where there's this little white girl sitting there, you know, at birthday parties and whatever, because I made myself a part of other families. And I think I survived through relationships and connection in an environment that was otherwise very, very chaotic.
So two things from that. One is, you know, you and I talked a little bit before we hit the microphone here. You know, school was a place that was really safe, right? I mean, not safe as in like, you know, nobody was bullying or anything, but once you got classroom, was that a place that was safe for you or?
No. So I think one thing, let me be clear. So as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I run a nonprofit for kids. I work with kids who come from backgrounds like my own. That's my passion. And I studied psychology and I'm really fascinated with attachment, and really attachment is biology. And when you look at why are human beings attached to one another, and you really get into things like Dan Siegel's work fascinates me, interpersonal neurobiology, you start to understand that there are different forms of safety. And so there's, you know, physical safety, which is the most obvious, but there's a thing called social safety, mm-hmm. right? And cultural safety. And when you are a child who comes from a household where your parents are using drugs, and you love them dearly, and you really feel they love you dearly, and you're told very explicitly that if you go to school and tell the truth of what happens in your house, you will be taken away, and you don't get enough sleep, and you show up in class, and your heart is pounding while, please don't let the teacher call on me, I won't know the answer, and you have lice in your hair and holes in your clothes, what essentially is going on for you all day is a series of rejections, and you're in a constant activated state of fear. And when people are in fear, or a child is scanning for what they perceive as threat, if the teacher finds out, they will take me away from my parents. Like, that teacher at any moment could be responsible for destroying my family. Right. So I'm sitting there scanning for threat. And what we now know about biology, right, neurobiology, is that when you're scanning for threat as a human being, especially a child, it gives you a very narrow attentional band. And that is a disaster for education. Correct. It is also a disaster for belonging. And I'm a firm believer that belonging leads to becoming. And when you're sitting in an environment that is diametrically opposed from your home life, a step toward that, you know, that successful environment is a step away from where you've come from. So you learn to navigate two worlds, and you never really feel a part of either of them completely because you are intrigued by school. There is food at school.
Right.
You know, there are good things about school, but how to truly integrate and become a part of it is a constant source of confusion. Which a child will blame that all on themselves.
Right.
So here you get a lot of kids in poverty operating out of shame. So no, it's more complex than that. I was terrified at school. You wouldn't have noticed it. I looked just like I was staring forward, but I was actually quite activated and scared.
Right. And I guess what I meant was not that it was a safe place, but it was like there's a difference in, like, when some kids go to school, it's those distractions and pressures aren't there, but they're a weight on them. And they can manifest, like you said, through anything. A teacher calls on me, now I immediately go to, oh my God, they're going to call social services or the other pieces. But, and then for some people, it's the only place in their life where they do get to eat, where they do get any positive affirmation or attention. And I think one of the great pieces of your book and your story is that it's an empathy builder, and it charges the batteries for a lot of staff who look out upon the students and don't have the ability to see them beyond the walls of their classroom. And there's a lot of teachers, you know, like myself back in the day, who view their room as like, this is a place anyone can be, it's safe, and those different pieces. And where, like you point out, where it's contrary to that is that child is sitting there thinking all day long, like, the bell's going to ring, I'm going to have to deal with these, or I'm going to have to navigate these four or five things throughout my day, and then I'm going to have to go home, and I don't know what's waiting for me.
Well, you know, maybe, but or maybe you do know what's waiting for you, but it's your parents who are sitting in the dark drinking, you know, right. and it's just sort of depressing there, and you love them, and all your love is bound up in their sadness. And so you do know what's going to happen, but in a sense, it's sort of just tragic. And at school, you are relieved to, oh my God, to get a meal at school. I was so hungry. So my parents would spend their check on drugs. They'd buy $30 worth of groceries, supposed to last for the whole month for all four of us, my sister, myself, them. And we just starved. So when I went to school, I was putting little milk containers in my pockets. I was really like, I ate everything I could. I don't think it went unnoticed, but you know, my story is not unique. So a lot of the kids were suffering that way. I'm actually very generic as a background, I believe. But you know, one thing that I think school does for you as well is it gives you a sense that there is another trajectory in society that maybe you could be a part of. and you don't really understand it. It almost feels like you're in a foreign country trying to learn the customs, and you don't have a translator. And it, so there's a sense of, I think, a craving to belong, mm-hmm. and then not really knowing how. I know I want to do well. And for teachers, oh God, who are my heroes, by the way? Teachers are my heroes. It's a complex task from a teacher's perspective. What should they do? And what I work with, you know, adults around how to be with children who come from my backgrounds. That is my passion. And so one thing I offer for people is just a simple framework. You know, you might want to look at your kids in the classroom and shift away from, if you find yourself looking at that child and saying, what's wrong with you? You might want to shift to what happened to you. And when you, that's a world of difference. And yet at the same time, know that what happened to them is not who they are. And there's more for them out there.
And that's, again, that's so powerful is if the more adults we can get to understand that point you just made, and the more adults we can get to recognize, and I'm not implying that a lot of teachers don't, but that whole acorn effect of, you know, just having the ability to move a kid and then change their life. So talk to us about that. When did education spark within you, and who are some of the people on that journey that shifted your direction?
Oh my God. I really know that my life was saved by caring relationships. It was saved. And a series of mentors came into my life, and one of them was very significant in high school. So here I am, just for context. You know, it was late 80s. It was New York City. My parents were, as I said, severely addicted, very loving in the way they could be, but severely limited and addicted. I believe, again, people can't give you what they don't have. So we didn't have this resentment, but it was a sure problem, like what to do. There was a neighbor in my building who made a big difference in my life by the name of Arthur. He became, in a sense, my first mentor around middle school years. And he just sort of noticed I was sitting on the stoop all day, and I just wasn't going to school. And my neighbors kept going, have a good day, and walking by. And he sort of didn't look away, you know, and he decided to play handball with me, ask me what I was reading, really kind of get into my life. And he began driving me to school. He was dear friends with my parents and, you know, had a lot of sympathy. And I think he really got the gravity of what this meant for my life. And that was one person who, over a 3.5 year span, made a tremendous impact in my life. He unfortunately died very suddenly of a heart condition we didn't know he had. And so I had this incredible experience for a period of time. And I would say that was my first saving grace, although it ended in tragedy. I ended up in a dire situation by the time I was, you know, you get to that age, you're in high school, you're picking out your prom dress, you're studying for your SATs. In my case, I was homeless at that age. I became homeless at the age of 15. My family had lost their apartment. I had experienced abuse in group homes and did not feel safe going back to state care. My mom was fading away in the hospital. My dad was living in a homeless shelter. And, you know, a lot of youth homelessness begins with couch surfing. And so I was couch surfing as though that was some kind of plan for my life. And I came to this pivotal moment when, you know, my mom, she passed away. I lost her, you know, around the time that I lost Arthur. And I had these two deaths that were back to back. And I was sitting in a hallway by myself at night. You know, here I am 15, just turned 16. My heart is broken. And I, you know, you get to these moments in life, I believe, and they happen over and over again, where you kind of, if you're lucky, and actually pain and tragedy do this, I think, they can cause you to let go of whatever is petty and really, really visit, what am I doing with my life? And I had a lot of those moments in staircases where I was sleeping as a teenager. My heart was absolutely broken. But I remembered at that time the many conversations I had had with Arthur, who was my neighbor. And, you know, he always just sort of spoke to, that's not who you are. You know, this neighborhood is not who you are. This life is not who you are. You have so much more in you than that. And I think what can happen for a young person is you can internalize the voices of the people who you know love you. They become a positive figure. They become the voice in your head that you hear when you're afraid. And with that behind me, I began knocking on doors and looking for an alternative high school. It took me some time so that when I was getting ready to register, I was going to be 17, where people like graduate and go to college. But here I am homeless. I've been shoplifting food, crashing at my friends' houses when I can. And I went on a series of, you know, interviews at these high schools. I always tell educators, you know, a kid, especially a kid from trauma, who knows how to pay careful attention to social cues, unfortunately too much attention, they know already whether or not you've decided something negative about them. And I would go into these interviews, and by the time the next school year started, I would be like one of the oldest kids in the school. I was starting late. I had a 42 average from previous failures. I smelled bad. My hair was in my face. I think my hair was purple. I was looking at the floor. I was like a no in so many ways. And so these educators initially, where it didn't work out, and I think this is a really important distinction, they sized me up and they were placating me, but the answer was clearly no. And what I say to people, and I was rejected several times and almost gave up before I got my one yes, I say to educators and any adults, really any human being, be really careful if you have gotten so used to telling people no, right? You just have this knee-jerk reaction. Some people, I believe, become a living no. Yeah. Have you ever walked up to a counter at an airport or something and you have a request? The person hasn't even heard you. No, the answer is no. And for a person who's in a vulnerable situation, when you are a no to them in that vulnerable situation, it could be such a difference in their life and they won't ever try again. And I was very close to not trying again because you can only take so much living, breathing no. And I walked into this one school and there was this one teacher who was my yes, and his name was Perry. No one else had said yes to me. You're too old. Go get your GED. Get out of here. Nothing wrong with the GED. I wanted a high school diploma. I wanted to go to college. And Perry looked at me and, you know, I'll never forget. I was so scared of him. I looked at the floor. I couldn't look at him. And to break the ice, he pointed to a pin on my backpack. He was wearing a tweed jacket, mind you, with elbow patches. But he said, where can I get a pin like that for my jacket? And it was a skull and bones, you know, and he made me laugh. And I think, you know, when someone cares about you and you know when they don't. So this man really nurtured me. He said yes. He did not know I was homeless. And it turned out that he had founded that school and hired a team of teachers who were as fantastic as he was. And I spent the next few years hiding my homelessness, going to school, and just being nurtured by a whole team of teachers who were essentially a living, breathing yes. And they believed in me. And that was all the difference.
So Liz, so the path of least resistance is no. It's always easy. Mm. It's so easy. And tell us, what are the characteristics of those yes people? The people who turn right off the path and go through the rocks, over the hills,
right,
climb a tree.
Yes.
What are their characteristics?
Well, you can be a yes person in a few directions, right? Because you can be a yes for yourself, like I'm going to keep going. And you can be a yes if you're an educator for young people. You know, so for instance, if you're a yes, like Perry was a yes, it's a person who they accept the human being and they understand the inherent value of that human being is unmistakable. It's not something that can ever be divested from the person. They're always going to be valuable. All human beings are valuable. So they see you and then they still hold you accountable for your behavior. You know, so like I told my teacher I wanted to get straight A's and he was like, we'll see what you do. You know, you got to work really hard. He knew I came from all this tragedy. He found a way to accept me as a human being and with zero wiggle room held me accountable for what I was going to do. And because in another way, you can accept a human being and you think that just coddling them is being a yes, but that's also being a no. They sort of see where you're headed. So they accept you, but they hold you accountable for your behavior. Now, internally for the self, being a yes, I think it's the willingness to just, I always tell people that my favorite motivational character of all time, like, and I've read all the books, I've gone to the Tony Robbins conferences, I've done the, you know, all that stuff. But my favorite motivational character of all time is Dory from Finding Dory. I have a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old. And when I took them to see that movie, I said, pay careful attention to her decision-making. You know, what's great about Dory? She has amnesia. She has no idea what happened before. All she ever does is that she faces every predicament, sort of looks to her left and her right, and she does the next right thing. And it is my strong belief that if you can find the wherewithal, which usually comes from love and good relationships and connection and knowing you're not alone, and it comes from inside as well, to just keep going. I tell people, if you go for it and it doesn't work out, I have really good news for you. All you ever have to do is go one more time. Because if that doesn't work out, you go one more time. And if that doesn't work out, you go one more time. And inch by inch, you carve out a new life for yourself.
So one of the other people I interviewed a couple a year ago was a gentleman who had cancer four different kinds five times, and he's lived through it. And he, just like what you just said, he lives by the concept of, I have a new point A.
Wow. So like, I love that. That's so succinct.
So and that's exactly what you just said. Okay, I don't know how the heck I just got here, but I have a new point A and I got to move forward. And I think for teachers, like you're stating, if they can give that to kids, and actually if anybody can just give that to everybody, move forward, themselves. Forgive. Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, you know, and actually there's something to that. So what I do know now, and I'm interested in a body of research that talks about, so the basis of mental health from this perspective is flexibility. So that mental health is essentially flexibility. And when we become rigid, right, when we become almost wooden about things. And we, you know, they say the two biggest impediments to learning and growth are the words "I know," right? And so when you come from the perspective of I have an instinct here, but I don't really know. And if you will remain flexible, that really is what it, I don't believe in white knuckle I think we misunderstand resilience. We think it's like white knuckle, push harder, willpower. I actually think that can be quite abusive to the self and not healthy mentally. I encourage people instead of that to think about flexibility. Because if you think about flexibility, all you will do is just the next right thing that you can think of. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what's going to happen and what's going to come. But I do believe that if you can do that, then you will wiggle your way out of a lot of things that once seemed impossible.
Right. Well, and again, like you said, that I actually agree with you. I think true resiliency is just, what am I going to do under this current set of conditions, and how am I going to move forward? And that's where my next question for you is. I have a personal belief based on my life experience that you can either succumb to your environment or you can overcome it, and neither are easy. But what are your thoughts when you hear that? Is succumb or overcome?
So that's interesting. You know, succumb. Well, could you elaborate on what you mean by succumb?
Well, you could very easily, like many others, have fallen right into the cycle of the environment in which you were raised. You could have, sure. You could have brought the disco era right into New Wave and right. Flock of Seagulls and all that other good stuff, right?
Yes.
So, or you could overcome and find a path. You know, when you say resilient. You know, when I read your story, and I'm not splitting hairs here, but you are very perseverant in your unwillingness to give up on yourself.
Mm.
And that's what I believe is overcoming. Any day you can succumb. I mean, you can fall into all different types of mindsets, but you can overcome or succumb to your environment. And that's, you know, what are your thoughts, especially now with your nonprofit and the kids you're supporting and their mentors? How do you
move that forward? Well, I think it's a really important question that you're bringing up here. I think it's really important. I think it's very rich, the question you're asking, because I come from the belief that more than one thing can be true at the same time. And I love the word you used about unwilling. Like, I'm unwilling. And I had a reputation in my family for being quite stubborn, you know, and I would often nag as a kid, why can't we do it this way? Why? And anything people said to me, you can't do it, I'd go, but what about this way? What about that way? And I think that that is critical. However, I don't think that it is enough. And I think that it is, nothing can happen until you develop the idea that you are responsible first and foremost. That is accurate. And nothing good can happen unless you decide to be unwilling, right? Like, you have to set that standard. That is accurate.
Yes.
However, we want to be careful, because you can make that kind of decision and work as hard as you possibly can and do the next right thing over and over again. And life circumstances can occur that can become so overwhelming for people that, you know, it's not that it didn't matter at all that they fought hard, but they're never, things happen to people. I work with a lot of people who come from situations where the stories I've heard, and I'm sure you've heard them too, they've done every right thing in their lives. And sometimes they get a diagnosis, a loved one passes away, they end up in caretaking, which is not valued in our society. And you can work as hard as you can and still have terrible things hold you back. And the more that our world becomes, our U.S. society, when people are working that hard and not making living wages and having a lot of things that are just sort of not coming together, you will have a better quality of life if you are unwilling to settle for less. But sometimes you do reach these limits. And what happens is we can become so overwhelmed, we turn inside and give up. And I want to just leave a little space for people who sometimes I've been in very dark places in my life. I've been in very, very dark places, as many of your listeners have, I'm sure, because we're human beings. So it's a tricky thing because you can work as hard as you can and still end up with a load on your back that's too heavy to carry. So I always want to leave a little space to say, if you're out there and you're listening and it feels like too much, I imagine that there are thousands of other people who feel that way. And I've felt that way. I'm sure I will feel that way again. And we're here with you. So I want to just hold a little space for that kind of suffering. And yet at the same time, this is why two things can be true at once. To be unwilling to leave it at that, to decide that no matter what happens, however hard it is, I'm going to keep going, is critically important. It's critically important. So both are true side by side.
Right. And that's what you talked about. I mean, and that's, again, I think that's one of the strongest and greatest powers of educators and people who just support others is those relationships and the ability to have somebody there who, when you're falling, may not reach out to catch you, may actually fall with you and stand by you and say, you know what, it's okay to cry. It's okay to be this way.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I'm going to guess there are not many people who told you, hey, Liz, I love your purple hair. At least not many adults. And yeah. when you run yeah. into a guy who, you know, the power of a compliment for anyone, especially a teenager who's naturally, you know, living in Brady Bunch is going through a ton of stuff, then compound it with all of his other experiences, just to be paid attention to is a powerful intervention in someone's life. And
very much. It's the difference for a young person. Cause also if a compliment is given and it's not sincere, right? The kid, no, what are they really looking for? Right. What are all human beings really looking for? We're mammals. We need groups. We need each other. We're looking for inclusion and exclusion. That's really, we're reading it. Do you include me? Do you exclude me? And I think the more that we can include people who come from a variety of backgrounds and honor where they come from and bring them into what we might have to offer and accept what they might have to offer, because all people have something to offer. You know, that is the big difference. And when you feel included and you are in a network of relationships where you experience that, I think that that is a protective factor when you're facing adversity. So you can be in the streets like I was, you can deal with a number of setbacks in life. But if you can think in your mind of who is it that is here for you, even if they've died, who loved you, I do believe people call on that. And that is really what gets us forward. In this world of increasing isolation, we need one another. And I, you know, so my passion, I use relationship-based education to build resilience in kids. And I firmly believe that relationships are at the core of all of this.
Do you think, so I have to ask you this. So there are many times in my life, I'm not going to talk about myself, but how, well, there are many times in my life where I hear a voice in my head, right?
Yeah.
And not like, you know, like weird, you know, I hear voices in my head. So
you're with us right now.
Yes, right. Right. As I swat away the imaginary voice.
Yes.
No, my point is this. I just did a podcast the other day about when I step to a door, I open it because in my head, I hear my mother and my grandmother saying, you will open that door for others.
That's what it is.
Yep. And I think one of the powerful things about your mission now is that you're creating that consciousness in their head of like, okay, I see something or I'm in a situation here and I hope they hear their mentor and I hope they hear you.
Right. So what you're describing when you're looking at that door and you're hearing the voices of your loved ones, we call that like a positive internalized attachment figure.
Mm-hmm.
So they say the way you raise your children, what the voice you speak to them in becomes the voice in their head. I'm interested in how for the time that we have with our kids, if we're educators or mentors, how can we become a positive internalized attachment figure is really the goal. So the kids in my program, which is called the Arthur Project, they get 500 hours of mentoring a year, every year in middle school, half in group and half one-on-one, and they all have growth plans. And we look at where they, and we track their progress, and we have like a plan for their lives. And even though we have a lot that they do, what I really focus on with between my mentors and mentees is that relationship. And if it had one goal, you need to be the voice in their head when they're facing challenges. Think about it. Anyone listening, I encourage them to think when you're really afraid, do you think of someone? Is there someone that you think of that helps, you know, and even if it's a voice in your head from your childhood or whomever. And I believe that that is really what holds us in times of adversity. And even though I had a lot working again, streets with my dad in a homeless shelter, my uncle who meant the world to me, I call him my uncle Arthur, really my mentor, my neighbor, my mother, they were dead, and I'm out there, like, I was alone, and I was terrified, but the voice in my head that I spoke to myself in, it was the voice of the people who loved me. And I do think that for our kids who are up against challenges, we want to think from that perspective, and that involves accepting our kids for who they are, loving them fiercely, and holding them to high standards.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, to your point, when I was a middle school principal, and I had, the regular in my office, about the third or fourth visit, I would just kind of close the door, sit down, and I'd ask him one question. If you had an accident in your pants at school today, who's the one adult you would go talk to?
Wow, what a question.
Well, because if you ask them, who do you trust? Yeah. Who do you like? They're like, no, I don't like anybody. Everybody sucks. But if you say, like, hey, listen, you peed your pants, who would you go talk to?
That's an amazing question. How efficient is that question?
Well, yeah, and then they'd be like, well, I would talk to so-and-so. The Arthurs of the world, in my world, the Johns, are people who are not necessarily the trained professionals. They're the lunch lady, the librarian, the janitor. They're anybody who gave them any attention. And what I found most often for those students when I asked that question is it wasn't necessarily a classroom teacher. It was just anyone who had been kind to them. And that's why your statement of the teacher Perry with the button, it just reinforces, I think, for a lot of teachers that it's the little things and it's the genuine pieces. Because I also heard from kids, I heard kids say to me, like, you don't know me like that. Leave me alone. And they'd walk away.
Right.
And I couldn't get through to them. And that's why, any guardian angels that we can find are awesome.
Right. That's true. And yet I would challenge everyone listening a little more than that, because first of all, what I hear is teachers are overwhelmed, they're overworked, right? And so and they have to get that curriculum in, and they're being held to these tests and standards. So I say this with that in mind. I actually believe we can do better for our kids than that, because I think that while we want to talk about the loving cafeteria person and the custodian, which is so often the source of safety and love in these school environments, actually, if we have an awareness of this being the first thing, that no significant learning can happen without a significant relationship, as Dr. James Comer says at Yale, who I love, if we understand that, then we can actually train our teachers to know that when you're speaking to a child in that way, here's what's happening. And we can support our teachers so that it's not just a burden of a concept on them, but I believe we can have a curriculum in schools that teaches sensitivity, attachment-informed teaching, right, and relationship-based education. And we can actually put a system in place around that, because that's what happens, right? If the kid trusts you, the kid will learn from you.
I agree.
And then we can train our entire school staff. We can do better than leaving it to chance.
When you ask a child in the classroom in front of everybody else if they have their homework done, and you know they don't have their homework done, you've committed a sin. And that's your point exactly. I can't have a strong relationship with you if every day I feel like you're out to get me. And although you may not be, if I, as the receiver of that type of a question, feel that way, I am at war with you.
So we've circled back to social safety.
Right.
Right, you see? So it's physical safety, social safety, cultural safety. There's different forms of safety. And if anyone's interested in this conversation, I strongly encourage you to look up Dr. Stephen Porges, P-O-R-G-E-S, and polyvagal theory. Polyvagal theory. And what you'll find are some incredible videos online about a theory that is, so there's a bundle of nerves that are attached to the base of our skulls as human beings, and then it goes all the way down and fans out to our viscera. That's our heart, our lungs. Mm-hmm. It is literally the physical attachment between our heads and our hearts. And what he looks at with polyvagal theory is when we're scared, we titrate. When we feel safe, we open. And then this raises a gorgeous question, which is, when we feel safe with one another, what is possible? What becomes possible in the context of safety, and how can we create that for one another, and particularly for our kids?
Well, and that's, the old stereotype of a broken heart. That's not fake. That's real. And that can be felt.
There's a neurological correlate for that feeling. A place in your brain that actually the same part of your brain if I hit your finger with a hammer, you'll see a certain brain light up. If you are socially rejected, the same part of your brain lights up. We do experience it as physical pain.
And we can grow it and strengthen it. And that's the other awesome part.
Yeah.
It's not just
most definitely.
Yeah. All right. So a couple more questions. This is awesome.
I love talking to you. This is great.
So fourth grade Liz. And so I'm going to ask you, two questions. So you reinforce a great point, which is, you know, the voice in your head that you hear is the one that from your home environment, et cetera. So my first question is, if you were to go talk to fourth grade Liz, yourself, what are the voices that you would put in her head? What would you tell
her? I think the number one thing is I would want to tell her you're already enough. Like, you were enough the day you were born. You're enough. And it's not about trying to become something. You are fine the way you are. You are already enough. I would also want to say that there'll be a lot of hard times, and that time was in fact a hard time, but this won't last forever. There will be an after, and that you have adventures waiting for you that are more beautiful than you could imagine. And I would say that even when you lose people, and you will lose people, that the love never leaves. You get to keep it, and it becomes a part of you, and it never goes away. So I think I would want to tell her that.
That is awesome. What are the voices in your kids' head, in your children's heads?
See, here's the thing. They have to tell me, right? So how do you know you're a good parent? Your kids will tell you. I can't be the judge of whether or not I'm a good parent. I don't get to say. So my 5-year-old and my 6-year-old, I hope, I can tell you what I hope and what I project onto them as their parent with my own blind spots and limitations. I will hope that if they peed their pants, as you said, if you, you know, went to the bathroom, that they would find that they could immediately come to me or my husband, their father. And I believe, and here's what's really amazing about the way that the human brain works and our bodies and our spirits and everything. I would hope that they really experience the love. So I feel like we're setting them up with this sense of a secure base, like you're unconditionally loved. What I notice is that, so my son, when he was born a few years ago, and I was sitting by his crib and I was singing him to sleep, I without any effort, without even trying, I started singing some songs that my mother sang to me I hadn't thought about in however many years. And I noticed that I started calling my daughter nicknames that my mom called me and my dad and Arthur and all kinds. And I just realized that we didn't have money. Our fridge was broken. We kept the milk on the windowsill outside. I had lice in my hair. We had a lot of problems. We had each other. And when you have each other, you have everything. And that love that was there, despite all of that, it still lives in me. And the love that was given to me then is now the love that I give to my children. And my relationship with them so far has been incredible evidence of how permanent those connections are. So I hope that my children receive that the way it is intended. And it's a day-to-day thing. It's not a fixed thing. It's a whole life's work. So check back in 10 years, and I'll have to ask my children, do you feel that you can turn to me? And I sure hope that they do. That would be, I would hope that my voice and my husband's voice are the voices in their heads.
So my kids are 10 years older than yours, and this is what I would tell you. Joy has no cost, but only dividends. And
ooh, I love that.
You will find that, you know, like you said, when you're singing a song to your kids, like you heard that from your mom or your dad, that you will see yourself in your children. And it is the most rewarding and terrifying thing at the same time as they are developing. And you're like, oh my God, like, he's got no dance moves just like you, or, you know, or at the same time, like, did you see how kind he was to that other person? And that's what we would expect. So that's awesome. What were some of the songs that were sung to you?
Oh, sure. Frère Jacques, You Are My Sunshine was probably the number one. Yeah.
That's awesome. And again, those are all learned things that suddenly some instinct pops up, your heart accelerates and fires your brain up, and it's just awesome.
Well, you know you've done a good job when the desire, the kid is scanning for, am I loved? And when they know they are, it is a felt sense. They just know it. It's not words. It's not really an intellectual thing from the neck up. It's in their heart, right? Like their guts. I am loved. It's a felt sense.
Right. Well, it's the intrinsic work that you're doing, you know, in every element of your life. That's, there's no greater reward than to walk away in the service of others. At least I believe that.
Right. Well, and what I always like to close that out with is just it works. It's bi-directional. So here we are working with an incredible group of kids in the Bronx. My pilot, the Arthur Project, is in two schools in the Bronx. And so we're not just like giving to these kids, right? Actually, they have so much to offer. And when we don't serve our kids, I think, well, you know, I go to a lot of banquets where we're giving out scholarships and we talk a lot about how great it is to give toward these children. But right, that's what everyone's saying. But when I get up at the podium, I always take a moment to look over the room and go, actually, let's shift this whole conversation. You know, if these kids don't get their scholarship, we miss out on what they have to contribute to society. Those are the bridges that never got built, and the doctors that never did the cures, and the teachers that never taught the next generation. They have a lot to offer. So what we're doing really is unlocking a mutual benefit. And that's what I'm really passionate about.
So tell me, what is a good day for Liz Murray?
A good day? Wow. Great question. First thing I think about is my kids. I mean, that's like the first thing. I mean, if I have, especially let's say it's a school day for them, like we have a really great morning, there are pancakes involved. you know, I cook them better than anyone else, you know, mom's pancakes. And so to see them really in a sense of this very, to see them joyful and to go off into the world doing whatever they're going to do that day, really secure and happy, that is really very valuable to me. Spending time with my husband, connecting with people I love. And I like to write, so I'm working on a second book and, you know, get a few pages in that really are based, they come from the heart and they're meaningful and honest, because that's where I think good writing comes from, the truth. And I work with my kids at the Arthur Project. I mean, that's like I get to hang out with them. They're hilarious. they are so beautiful. So really, you'll notice a lot of relationships inside of that answer. And, you know, a day where I've moved the needle toward all these pursuits going in a good direction and I've connected with, in a sense of relationship and love with people who are meaningful to me is a great day.
So here's my last question for you. I have one of my heroes is my father-in-law, and he has this saying that, you know, like my car, when I was in college and I'm dating my wife, who's his daughter, I would say like, oh, you know, my clutch blew out of my car. I don't know how I'm going to get down to school and blah, blah. And he'd say, what a wonderful problem. What a good problem.
I love that.
What do you think of when you hear good problem?
I love that. Oh my God. That's, that really just, my whole brain's lighting up for that because, that hit such a button for me because I don't mean to sound trite about adversity. Okay. Because let's be serious. Like sometimes it's so overwhelming as we already talked about, but there is this, I remember being in the middle of, I have to go back to this because it was such an empowering shift. And I hope by mentioning this specific example, it can be useful to others. I was sitting down, I was going to be the same age as a college freshman, but I was starting high school. I was like really in a bad situation. Again, my family had died. I'm living in the streets. And I remember taking out a marble notebook. And I had scribbled I always kept journals. I had written all these pages about all my problems and kind of what was in the way and what was in the way. And then I sat there at one moment and I just started laughing. And I know that sounds awful, but I started laughing at how horrendous all these things were, genuinely horrendous. And I pictured this runner. I remember in my mind, and it was the difference for me, this runner, and she was running a racetrack that had these little obstacles on them that caused her to jump over them. And I started to make a list of all the things that they were the same circumstances, but if I took them and lined them up and saw them more as a checklist, like hurdles to go over, like, of course it's supposed to be difficult. Why would you expect life to not be difficult? You know, Scott Peck in my favorite book, The Road Less Traveled, the first sentence, life is difficult, right? So the expectation that it should be difficult will set you up to win. Because if you put those obstacles and you say, okay, these are not things blocking me, these are things when I overcome them, it's going to be so much more inspiring. So when I hear that question, it really inspires me to think, isn't it great to be alive today? Number one, to have a problem, you know, and the gratitude that I have for being alive. And the next thing I think is that often the solutions you create in your life that come out of the worst problems will be the most meaningful solutions. Mm-hmm. And so, right. And that's what comes to life, which you can access all of that thinking from a place of gratitude, right? Like, And what is gratitude? It's knowing that everything you have in your life, you could just as easily not have it. That's all it is. So that's, I love that question. And I think I'm going to use that. Can you say the sentence one more time, how he says it?
Well, he just simply says that what a good problem.
What a good problem to have. Yeah, that gives me everything.
It doesn't matter. You know, I'll send you the podcast I wrote about it because it doesn't matter. I mean, this is a guy, the kind of classic American, second generation Italian, went to dental school, you know, got everything he dreamed of. He's done. And he still maintains the, you know, we didn't have a car when we were kids. My dad was this kind of, you know, this is what I grew up in. And boy, what a great problem. What a great problem. We're out to dinner and that lady's not getting us water and we're thirsty. What a great problem. And he transforms everyone he's around because normally you're ticked, right? You get spoiled. Like, where's my water? I can't believe, I want my ranch dressing, you know? And you forget, he keeps you grounded.
Oh, that's so great. That reminds me, I forget which comedian it was, but many years ago, I watched a skit about a comedian who talked about people being on an airplane. And they were complaining because I didn't want the salted peanuts. I want the unsalted. And they're getting like all triggered about some peanuts. And then he yells into the microphone, "You're flying through the sky on a giant piece of metal. Right. You know, it's a miracle." Right. And
I've seen that skit too, because he says you're strapped into a chair going 400 miles per hour.
Right. And that's right. And so if I had a religion, that would be my religion. Right. Like that in essence is. It is so critical to just look at whatever you're up against, even the problems themselves, perhaps especially the problems as, you know, I get to be here. And there's an experience I can have in this. And I think that what takes us out of that is entitlement. You know, it's like I deserve to have the peanuts that I asked for.
Right.
Right, is one way to look for it. The other one is like I'm on an airplane. I've got these peanuts are cool. Someone picked these out of their shells and put them in a bag for me. And I'm sitting here and I'm headed somewhere. Where am I headed? I'm alive. I'm here. If you can do that, then you will shift your mindset from scanning all day for what you don't have. And you will work with what you do have. And my friend, that is everything. That is love. That is gratitude. That is problem solving. Really, I think that's your best possible life if you can access that distinction.
Well, and you're talking about humility. And I'm guessing that you find yourself, you know, you're on Oprah, you're in all these places and you've got to be, you know, like I tell this to everybody I meet. I would be sitting listening to the high school orchestra and I would lean over to the person next to me and go, "Can you believe we're getting paid to sit here?" Like someone's paying me to listen to this joyful, beautiful music and see these kids. And I think that's just spending this time with you, watching you on video, you can tell there's a groundedness to you, but you clearly elevate everyone around you, which is just fantastic. So
I if you're not playful in life, if things aren't funny to you, I had such horrible stuff happen to me and I look at my group of friends who are in the hallway just with nothing and we just started laughing, you know, and you can't always do that. Okay. Sometimes I get it. Please know I get it. But sometimes if you can just laugh at the absurdity of the fact that we're even on this planet for the time we're here, I just see it in that way. It really does. It carries the day.
Right. And that goes back to say, Arthur, for you, like, you know, moving you and grabbing you at that moment and playing handball and just, if we can't, you know, just that moment of fun, that quick opportunity to build a relationship. And it's just, it inspires a thought in me that my wife said a couple of weeks ago, which is, if I'd have known that was the last time we were ever going to do that, I would have done it differently. And that was a life shifting quote. Like, you know what, everything we're going to do, we're going to do it like this could potentially be the last time we ever do this with our kids or our family or whatever. Because then it will be fun and we won't have worries or regrets. So
I live a little bit like that. Like this is, you know, I sometimes feel like I'm, you know, I'm an old lady in a rocking chair thinking back on my life and I'm visiting where I am from there. And I've been sent back to really make sure I enjoy it this time. Yeah. So it feels.
And I'll leave you with this. My grandmother, you know, orphaned, Depression era, grew up and, you know, bouncing around all over the place. Her last words to me as she held her hand and she passed away the next day were, "Teddy, in the end, it's all going to work out." And I think that if we work towards that every single day, it will.
Beautiful.
You're proof positive of that. So this has been a very joyful conversation that will pay dividends for me and I think our listeners forever, Liz. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
So let's do some smart thinking. Wow. What can you take away from this? How can you apply her story to support the needs of others? And what are you going to do different in order to serve those who need the greatest amounts of support so that they propel themselves to excellence? That's it. That's the Smart Thinking Podcast. As always, thank you for listening, and please share this episode on your social media platform and take a listen to those awesome musicians, the Wellpennies.